I like things to happen fast. And that's just not the way that hiring works, right? Is you do want to take a little bit of time to make sure that you're getting the right candidates. But at the same time, in a hot job market or with jobs that are really low supply of talent for them, you have to move fast in order to get the talent, right, that you need.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to founders and executives disrupting their industry about what they see uniquely and differently when it comes to identifying top talent. If this is your first episode, thank you so much for joining. For our longtime listeners, we really appreciate the support. Please subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and give us a great rating. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by Tim Raines. He is the Chief Information Security Officer at ABC Security. How you doing, Tim?
It's great to be here, Oz.
Glad to have you, bud. Now, I got to say, there's a little bit of irony here. We were just talking a little football earlier because the Super Bowl. You said you're a Seahawks fan. Your last name is Raines. Is there any type of correlation or irony because it rains so much up in the Pacific Northwest?
Don't even get me started talking about the weather. But it's true. We are the Raines of Seattle. So there is a little bit of irony there. Yep.
I love that. I love that. So great city. Love the area. I've spent some time up there myself. But I want to dive into your career. I want to understand a little bit. You work in the security industry. And I just want to frame this properly. There's cybersecurity. There's a lot. But you do security monitoring, right? Particularly for residential homes, previously for commercial entities as well. So if somebody breaks in, the alarm goes off, or if there's a fire, there's video cameras, any of that good stuff. So the monitoring of our homes and the safety of our homes, I am an ADT customer, is what your business does. But you are the Chief Information Security Officer. So can you give me some insights into what that role in particular does, what the scope of it is, and then tell us why it's important?
Sure. Yeah, I put my job into sort of two buckets. So the first thing I do is enterprise cybersecurity. So that means I'm really in charge of making sure our customer data, first and foremost, is secure and prevent threat actors and bad guys from getting access to it. And they're constantly trying to do that with every company these days. And so whether it's customer data or employee data, intellectual property, it's all super important to the company and to our shareholders. And so that's a primary concern of mine. The other bucket of work that I have is around product security. So to make sure the hardware and software that ADT produces and sells to customers and partners and so on is as secure as it can be. And that's a journey as well, because there are people out in the industry are constantly doing security research. And so that landscape changes constantly and very quickly. So those are the two buckets. The reason it's important is you described ADT as this home monitoring company, but it's actually a little bit broader than that. So not only does it focus on consumers, but it also focuses on small business. And there's a ton of small businesses out there. But we consider ourselves a life safety company. And so it's true, you're securing the doors and the windows, and we've got video cameras, and we're looking for people breaking into organizations and homes and so on. But it's also, hey, we're monitoring for fire, we're monitoring for carbon monoxide, and really, it really is around safety and life safety. And so that's what gets me super motivated about this particular job, is the charter is really important, right? Making sure that you and your family don't die from a carbon monoxide poisoning event, or helping you if it detect a fire very early on so we can limit the damage and get people out of the home or the small business, right? So it's super important. That's what drew me to this brand. It's a 150-year-old company. And I've been an ADT customer a couple of times in my life before starting to work at ADT. And it's been fantastic. Being a cybersecurity guy, it's really cool working in a security company because everybody gets it. And that's why they say every second matters. That's our mantra here. And it's really cool. Like working with people that are super passionate about security and about our customers makes my job much easier.
I love that. And I was going to ask you, because you worked at some humongous brands like T-Mobile, Amazon, Microsoft, and what drew you to ADT? But it's obviously the mission. It's obviously the vision. And to your point, it seems almost triply important to be in the information security space for a company that, at the end of the day, security, every second matters, is their brand. That's who they are. So it's got to make it easier to work because everybody already understands the imperative and how critical it is. I'm interested just to get people a little bit of back ends. Companies deal with these threats all the time. So if something happens, you're like up late at night, you're on the phone, like you're going into firefighting mode, and I'm sure you've gone through many of those incidents throughout your career. Is it as exhausting as it sounds? And is it something that you can give us any kind of like back end window to in terms of what it looks like or feels like on the job side?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting because the incident response portion of these cybersecurity teams, it can be very exhilarating to work on one of those teams, as long as it's not high volume, right? So if you're constantly having intrusions, if you're constantly exercising your IR team, it can absolutely be exhausting. But really, IR is about setting hypothesis and then testing that hypothesis. Hey, we think this is what happened. And then you go and you look for the data that helps you prove or disprove that hypothesis. So it's a series of hypothesis and testing hypothesis. And what it's a very interesting question, because what ends up happening is what you think at the beginning of an incident is likely going to be wrong by the time you get to the end of the incident. And so you have this series of, I think I know this, and then you go and prove whether or not you know it. And after you prove yourself like you don't know several times, you can become disheartened to the point where you no longer know what to believe, right? You no longer know what's true and what's not true. And then usually at that point, you start to get some data that helps you understand what's actually going on, right? So depending on how deep that rabbit hole goes, it can be really exhilarating and you're like, wow, this is really interesting how these attackers did this stuff. Or it can be just like mind-numbing, like we can't figure it out and it's taking a long time. And IR teams tend to want to keep working until they've got the puzzle solved, right? Because time is super important, right? Getting containment is super important, and detection and containment is what it's all about, really, once you get into an incident. And so you can't get it done fast enough. And it can be a journey. If you're having problems figuring out what really happened, it can be exhausting. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like the definition of strong opinions held lightly. You go in there with a thought and idea to attack it, and then you've got to be very open to new information, new data, pushing you in different directions. I can definitely see where it's exhilarating, but also stressful. And you just got to stay out in front of the bad guys, right? They're constantly innovating and thinking of different ways they can do things. And so a big part of what you and your team do on the IR team, I'm sure, is just staying out in front of those new innovations or new technologies in that space that the bad actors will bring to the table. Fascinating stuff, man. I'm not sure I'd want to be the guy on the call at 2 a.m., but I find it very interesting and I appreciate you give us the insight on it. Let's talk a little bit about the companies you worked at previously, because there are obviously some of the who's who in technology in particular. Let's start here. So I'm interested to know what kind of a main learning or takeaway, one of the things that you said, I left this company and brought this with me throughout the rest of my career. Let's start with Microsoft.
Yeah, spent 17 or 18 years at Microsoft and did a whole bunch of different roles there. But the two loves of my career there were networking and cybersecurity. And back then, the best cybersecurity folks were networking folks before they became cybersecurity folks, because it turns out like 99% of the attacks happen across the network, right? And so if you can understand TCP/IP, if you understand how the operating systems do networking, you have a pretty good insight into what the attackers are doing, at least from that perspective, right? That company, Microsoft, back in those days, like I joined their incident response team. I was employee number 3 on their incident response team. I think it was 2003. I joined that team on a Thursday, and that Saturday, SQL Slammer hit the internet. And so it was like baptism by fire, right? Slammer, Blaster, MyDoom, Sasser, it just goes on and on. All the worms that hit us back in 2003, 2004, before Windows had the firewall turned on by default, it was just one after another. So I started as employee number 3 on that IR team. And before I left, we had 125 people doing IR 24/7. And so what I took from that job, I had the opportunity to develop all the tools that we use to do IR there, like to determine is a Windows system actually compromised or not. And what I took away from that job was a very well-developed sense of urgency, right? You cannot do this stuff fast enough, right? When a customer calls and says, I need to know if this server's been compromised, that's a big deal. And so being able to do that in a way that's efficient and really respects the urgency the customer has at that point, like the organization, they really need an answer to that question. So that's what I took away from that job. And it was an incredible experience because the Microsoft has so many smart people there. I still know a million people. I actually live not far away from Microsoft headquarters here in Washington. Yeah, so I still have plenty of friends that work at the company and so on. But that was an incredible experience, learning about cybersecurity in the early days, how all the attackers did what they'd, how do they actually operate? And it turns out that, yes, sure, there's been some novel things that they've discovered along the way, and they've got some new techniques and tactics. But frankly, I still see the same techniques and tactics I saw back in 2003 being used here in 2025. It's old wine and new bottles, right? It was an incredible experience, though, like that. Just watching attack after attack and learning from attackers was really helpful early in my cybersecurity career.
Really early in the maturity of internet, and obviously Microsoft being at the forefront of technology at that time, probably the premier technology company to work for at that time, I'm sure you learned a lot and got to see a lot. So really cool stuff. What about at Amazon? That's obviously no slouch itself, and you got there a little bit later in their journey, but tell us about what you took away from Amazon.
Yeah, so I worked at Amazon for about 4.5 years. The first 3 years of that, I was actually based in London in England. I was their security and compliance leader for public sector in Europe, Middle East, and Africa. So I literally got paid to travel around Europe and talk to people about how the cloud could help them with their security and compliance and show them how AWS works. And I learned so much about cloud computing. Like I thought I knew a little bit about it at Microsoft because we were already doing Azure and Office 365 and so on. But I really got like a really good view into what cloud is all about and how a hyperscale cloud provider like Amazon, like how they do business. That whole culture that they have there is pretty tremendous. The whole thing around writing 2 pages or 6 pages, depending on what you're doing, and really having to be concise about what you want to do and why you want to do it and what its benefit to customers is. And that kind of discipline was really cool to see, because at Microsoft, it was all about PowerPoint and doing presentations and so on. But at Amazon, it was all about writing your ideas down and being forced to being really concise about it. And then the meetings, you would spend the first, let's say, 15, 20 minutes of a meeting reading the 2-pager with everybody else. And then after that, after everyone's finished reading, then you would discuss the idea. And that type of discipline was like an eye opener, right? Like forcing people to come to the meeting, and you don't expect them to be prepared coming in, because you're going to give them the first 15 minutes to prepare just like everybody else. So when you finally talk about the ideas in the meeting, everybody just read the paper. Everybody has it front of mind. No one's coming in from left field without knowing what they're talking about. And that's really powerful. Like being able to know what you're talking about in every single meeting is truly powerful. It was a great experience.
Yeah, I just finished reading a little while ago. It might be How Amazon Works or What Works, but it really breaks down like all the, it's from some of the early employees there in terms of the 14 leadership principles, right? The 2-page writing assessment when you come before meetings that you're supposed to read beforehand. So the fact that you have the 2-pizza rule in terms of how many people are in the meetings. And I think one of the things that, there's a lot of things that I took away from it, right? Including like how they, like some of their failures and some of the ways they went to market on different things in really innovative ways. But one of the things that I like to do here now is the PR and FAQ, right? When we have an idea or we have something we want to implement, write a PR release, which I think is a really good thought exercise. To think about it from a change management perspective, right? When you get people excited about something in the organization, you write it in that. But then also going through the diligence of what are the questions that are going to be asked and how we're out in front of that. We've done that for a couple of different programs that we put in place here at MSH. And it's worked wonderfully because it gives the people who are building the outcomes or building the processes and outcomes a different lens on how they have to think through things, so you're more comprehensive. So that's awesome. It sounds like that played a huge part in who you are as a leader. And then T-Mobile?
Yeah, T-Mobile. So I got hired at T-Mobile in the wake of a big breach there, and they were getting more serious about cybersecurity there, and got to work with super smart people again, like people that literally invented the mobile technologies and protocols that we all use now every single day with our 5G, 4G networks and so on. And so again, got to work with super smart, super good people there. And the challenge was huge because you've got like the largest 5G network in the world, and these bad guys just keep coming and coming. And so that was a really big job, huge network, couple hundred thousand, 200,000-300,000 people that you're working with at the company, including like contractors and so on. And really trying to bootstrap the cybersecurity program and get it going down the right tracks, right? And that was a tough gig. Again, that IR background and that sense of urgency I learned at Microsoft was very helpful there, just because of the circumstances and just how busy it was there. And got to work with some tremendous people. I actually had a huge team there. And so like the Amazon thing gave me the international experience that I was looking for working in Europe. This was like big team experience. I was managing probably 450 people on that team. And so I had managers of managers. Like it was a huge team. And I was one of three of the most senior leaders on that team. It's really great experience, great professional development experience, great company. The company was totally behind their cybersecurity team and really committed to moving in the right direction there. And so I worked at T-Mobile for about 2.5 years. We made some huge progress there in 2.5 years. I've been gone now from there for about a year, and they've continued. The momentum is just really fantastic to see. And yeah, really good company and smart people.
Love that. All right, I want to take it a little bit of a different direction before we get into hiring. You and I talked in our pre-call about mentorship, and that's something that's been really important to you throughout your career. I think both being mentored and being a mentor for others. You've worked at companies like Microsoft. I think my understanding is they have formal mentorship programs there. What do those look like? How are they set up and how can they be effective? Because I feel like sometimes I've seen those in companies and it's not always effective, right? Or it's like perfunctory. How does a company like Microsoft do it differently that makes it more effective and impactful in terms of the employees?
Yeah. I've been lucky. I've been able to participate in mentorship programs, both as a mentee and a mentor. So at Microsoft, I was first a mentee there for a while, and then I was a mentor. At ADT, I just actually finished a mentorship program where I was mentoring, you know, what they call a circle of people, right? So at both Microsoft and ADT, we had these mentor circles. And so at Microsoft, I was involved in mentoring MBA students that they were hiring from different MBA programs around the US. And at ADT, I was mentoring early stage managers. So people that were already managers had worked their way into management roles. The key to both of those programs in my mind is the availability of other mentees, right? So as a mentor, I learn a lot from the mentees, like what is their challenge? And many of them have the same challenges. They're wondering, how do I manage up? How do I get my next promotion? How do I make it to an executive role? A lot of them are looking for a path forward and they're looking for tips and tricks to help them. And the earlier you are in your career, the more you ask, hey, how do I get my first promo, right? But the key in my mind, the thing that I've seen work well is just having a mentor circle where you have multiple mentees and sometimes even multiple mentors, and people get the benefit of learning from each other, right? And so I learn a lot from the mentees myself and from other mentors. And when you get a group of them together, they realize they have very similar interests and very similar challenges, and they learn from each other. And that interaction is just as important as an interaction between a mentee and a mentor. So just getting people together that have common goals, if you will, is how to move forward in their careers, how to develop their careers, and getting them in a forum where they're willing to talk with each other and be a little vulnerable and share things with each other. That's where, in my opinion, I've seen the most growth happen.
Have you had anybody that you mentored, whether it be at Microsoft, ADT, or anywhere else, that you've seen like there was a big impact? And can you tell us a little bit about what that was?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Back in the day at Microsoft, everybody, like, especially if you're a new MBA, a new minted MBA, you come out of school and your first question is like, how do I move ahead in my career, right? And so it's like I've seen two approaches to career development. One is work to endear yourself to your line of management and become like that trusted person they can go to with any kind of problem, and they know that you'll solve it. And once that happens, you can really move up quite quickly. And so I worked with some mentees that actually followed that route, which is really to understand their line of business and just become that go-to guy or gal for the management of that, or very trusted resource for that management. And you tend to move up very quickly when you do that, right? So I saw some people that I mentored really embrace that approach and really move up. They got up to director within a few years, which is really an accomplishment at a company like that. The other approach is to do, and this is the approach I took in my career, is the skills and experiences inventory. Like, what skills and experiences do I already have? Take that from all of the jobs that I've worked in my career and kind of map them to an inventory. So if you imagine you have different business disciplines like finance, sales, accounting, and so on, and then you have experiences like, hey, I worked with public sector, private sector, and so on. Just figuring out which of those I really got and then which of those experiences I don't have yet. And trying to continually to broaden my experiences, because what happens is after a while, you have so much experience and so many skills that it makes you a better business leader. Suddenly more about business generally than other people around you, right? And you have that business acumen, right? So that might take longer, but in my experiences, you're a little bit more portable after that. I can go, I'm not endeared to a single line of business. I can actually, my skills and experience are applicable to almost any business that is looking for someone like me, right? And so those are the two approaches. And so I've helped people with both of them. The folks that do the kind of the long-term, the skills and experiences approach, it's a really long-term strategy, but those are the people that tend to do really well in the long-term, like over a period of 5 to 10 years. And so I've seen people that I've worked with in the past that worked on my teams who are now like have, you know, great jobs, leadership positions, general manager, VP type positions in a really good companies now. And when I talk to them, they often refer back to that learning, like it was an epiphany for them, right? Is trying to figure out what skills and experiences they don't have. And instead of avoiding them, actually investing the time and effort to get those. Because when I did my first skills and experiences inventory, I was like checking the same boxes for every single job. And that's because I was good at it. It was fun. I got recognized because I was good at it. I got incentivized because I was good at it. But I just kept going for those jobs with the same skills and experiences because of that. And when I shifted and started going after job or looking for projects and jobs and so on that gave me different experiences outside of those two, that's when I really started to broaden. And so I did spend time at Microsoft in corporate communications and PR. And so you're not going to meet very many CISOs in the industry that worked in led corporate communications teams at a Fortune 2 company. That's a differentiator for me. When I show up now, other executives look at that experience and say, wow, like that guy has a depth of experience across different disciplines, as opposed to he really knows that one line of business really well. But there's no right answer. It's just I've helped people with both approaches and I've seen good success using both approaches.
So what about if somebody, because I get this a lot, if somebody wants a mentor, they want somebody to help them, but they don't work at a company that has one of these formal programs. Do you have any advice for people like that?
Yeah, in cybersecurity, we have these industry associations that can be very helpful. And they do have like chapter meetings and they do have online portals and so on. And there's always people that are willing to mentor newer folks in cybersecurity at those industry associations. So like ISSA, ISACA, ISC Squared, the Cloud Security Alliance. These are all industry associations that have like people that have decades of experience in them. And so just showing up to the chapter meetings and getting to meet people, getting to know people, that's a really good way to find a mentor if you're not in a company with a structured mentoring program.
Okay, Tim, awesome stuff. I appreciate you sharing that. And I think that's going to really be helpful to somebody that's maybe thinking about what can I do to maybe get involved with mentorship, particularly if they're in the cybersecurity space. What I'm interested to talk to you about now before we get into the hiring is when someone's an expert in something, you say they wrote the book on, and you literally did write books, right? And in your space, in your area of expertise. Sounds like a little bit ago too. So I'm just interested, what caused you to decide to write books? And can you tell us a little bit about the books in case anybody wants to pick them up?
Sure. Yeah, no. So I've written a couple of books on cybersecurity. The title is Cybersecurity Threats, Malware Trends, and Strategies. I've written two editions of this book. The first one was, it took me about 14 months to write. It was about 420 pages. And then the second one is another 150 pages on top of that and took me about 7 months to write. So it's a lot of work to write a book. I had no idea when I started just how much work. But what attracted me to this is like when I worked at Microsoft, I blogged a lot. Like you could go up and look up Tim Raines Microsoft and still find blogs from, you know, 2007 or 2012, so a long time ago now. But I wrote a lot of blogs and I always tried to share the insights that I got working at Microsoft and security with other people. And I left Microsoft. I just found myself in jobs that I wasn't doing any writing. And so I really crave the writing process because it helps me understand the topics better when I'm forced to write about them. And so again, it goes back to that experience at Amazon when you sit down and actually write something and you have to be concise and people are going to be critical if you're not. So I sat down to write these books and I wrote the first three chapters of the first book before I went out and found a publisher because I wanted to be sure I actually could do it. I had some friends that had written books and they're like, look, you got to be committed because you're going to write at least 10 chapters. Each chapter is going to be a minimum of 25 pages. So it's not like writing a blog that's two or three pages long. This is you're committing to writing 250 pages plus on a schedule. And it turns out that's really hard because as you submit chapters, they're coming back from, let's say, a technical review. And then you've got chapters that were technical reviewed coming back from an English review. And so by the time you finish a book, you've written it three times. So it's not for the faint of heart. And I did it the first time. Like I said, it took me about 14 months. It took me 2.5 years before I was interested in writing again. And so I wrote the second edition, and it was more interesting because I put some things in there that I learned living in Europe. So things like government access to data is the most important topic in Europe to European IT professionals and cybersecurity professionals, because it all goes back to, you know, what happened in the Second World War and all of the breaches in privacy that were happening because of the war and so on. And we don't really understand that in North America, how it's linked, like how this whole, how privacy is so central to the way Europeans see the world because of what happened during World War II. And so that whole kind of cultural thing, if you travel to Europe and you steep yourself in it for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and then travel back, you don't really get it. But once you live there and you're immersed in it, you know, week after week talking to people about it, you suddenly begin to realize like just how central it is to the way they see the world, right? And so this is what really ends up like the tension between Europe and the United States, specifically about privacy and all the data transfers happening between the US and Europe and so on, and how to protect them, really important to them. I wrote some chapters in the book on government access to data and the role of government in cybersecurity, in addition to malware and cybersecurity strategy and so on. So it was the second one to me was a more interesting book just because I added more context. That was,
sounds like you got more concise in the pages. Pretty soon we're gonna have your 30 page book coming out soon. I gotta say, that's really fascinating. As somebody that's built software and is familiar with GDPR, we've done a lot of work in Europe. I don't know that I ever tied back the understanding of World War II and why that privacy is so important and so managed the way it is. That makes total sense from just a cultural perspective. Oh, wow. Really great stuff, Tim. I appreciate you sharing that. I'll have to pick up that book. Might have to lock off some time for about 150 pages. I can get through that pretty quick. Let's talk some hiring real quick. So I want to understand from your perspective, you obviously hired a lot of people throughout your career. Do you have a core hiring philosophy that you like to adhere to when it comes to bringing people into your team?
You know, what's interesting, that's another thing that Amazon is really disciplined about, is the way that they do interviews, job interviews and so on, is very structured. And it's structured around those leadership principles that you mentioned earlier. And each interviewer will take a few of those principles and dig into them with the candidates. And I found that was really time consuming, but it also really did uncover the best candidates, right? Most companies don't take that approach because it's super time consuming. And you interview a lot of candidates before you find like one hire, right? Using that approach. So today I use a hybrid of that. Like I have those kinds of questions in the back of my mind in that approach. But what I'm really looking for is, as an executive, is this person a fit for the culture? Are they fit for the team? The other interviewers are going to dig into the technical stuff and figure out, does this person have the right skills and the right experiences to do the job that they've applied on? But for me, it's always about the organization and the fit for the org, the fit for the culture, and helping us drive the culture forward. If they do have the technical acumen that we're looking for, it really does come down to, hey, is it a great fit for the culture? Because if it's not, then it's not going to be a good job for them. It's not going to be a good experience for them. And it's not going to be a good fit for the company either, right? That's where these internships, we do a lot of internships at ADT. We did a lot of them also at Microsoft when I worked there. That's a great approach because it allows you to try before you buy, right? So it allows the candidate to like determine whether they like the company, whether they like the people and the culture, And then it gives them a little bit of experience that the company is looking for so that when they finish their internship, if there's jobs available for them after their internship, like they're first in line for those jobs because they understand the culture already. They're a good fit for the culture and they do have some of the skills. So we get a lot of value from internships. So I highly recommend those as well.
Yeah, I was just taking some notes. You're really preaching to the choir on some of this stuff. The two companies I look up to the most in terms of the way they go about their hiring is Amazon and Google. And there's a lot of like great tenets of we've built this optimal hiring process in our company that we recommend to our clients based on feedback turnaround and requirements gathering and how you align the interviewing and all that good stuff. And a lot of our tenets based off of what I've seen from Google and Amazon. And to me, like, you make time for what's important. And if you honestly believe that the people you bring into your organization ultimately are going to lead to success, or if you hire the wrong person, how detrimental that can be, then you take the time to be able to do that. So one of the things that we're doing from a software perspective is using AI to minimize the amount of time, but still give you the same great outcomes that come with that. But yeah, I just think it's so important to be thoughtful up front, thoughtful after the fact. Sometimes you've got to kiss a bunch of frogs to find your prince or princess. And that's not a bad thing. What's worse is settling, right? Or taking a yeah, maybe on a candidate, because those almost always never work out. And then you're just spending more time unwinding that, at least a lack of productivity, culture, toxification, all that good stuff. So we're all that bad stuff. So yeah, totally aligned with you on that. What about, do you have a question? I'm interested as we go back and you try to align those leadership principles, is there any question that like routinely comes up for you in your interviews?
Yeah, for me, the one question I always found really effective at determining whether someone's going to be a fit or not was, tell me about a time, a lot of their questions start like that, tell me about a time when you made a commitment and you failed to deliver that commitment. Okay, why did you fail and what happened? And what you're trying to identify in a question like that from a culture perspective, is this person going to blame the people around them or are they going to take responsibility themselves? And so if they start blaming other people or they blame their circumstance, that might all be true, right? But it gives you some insight into their character and you can decide, is this a good fit for the team? But it's really like the people that did the best, you know, perform the best in those questions typically take responsibility for whatever happened, right? So they pick a scenario where they made a commitment, they were responsible for it, and they don't mind standing up and saying, yeah, I failed, but this is what I learned during that failure. It's about learning. And so it really is like a great question. I've used it for years and years, but help me understand what kind of person you are. What kind of character do you have? Or is it easy for you to blame other people? Or are you the type of person that just is accountable to yourself and you don't mind saying that?
Accountability is super important. What about maybe a memorable interview experience? Are there any that come to mind maybe at one of these other companies? Good, bad?
I'll tell you what. At Amazon, they had a thing called a bar raiser. And they were the one role that could essentially veto a hire. And I built some teams, some large teams there. And it would take so long to hire people. And every time you would get all the interviewers saying, hey, this person's a hire, and the bar raiser would veto it, it would just, I want to pull my hair out, right? Because we just had 4, 5, 6 people interview them. And the only person that's not convinced is the bar raiser. And that's there for a reason. They use that to make sure that the hiring manager is staying consistent with the hiring principles, like with the leadership principles and so on. So it's a safety valve just to make sure that the hiring manager makes the right choice, that they're not just hiring because they need people, but they're actually maintaining those leadership principles in the hiring process.
And in my understanding is the bar raiser would come out from outside of your function. They'd have no kind of incentive or agenda.
When I worked there, they were in a pool, so you never knew where they'd come from. If you had a bar raiser on your own team, you could potentially use them, but normally it would come out of the pool, so you wouldn't know where they would, you know, what part of the company they were coming from. And since they focus on leadership principles, it doesn't matter if they're a cybersecurity expert or not, because they're really just focused on leadership principles and your fit for the Amazon culture.
Yeah, so read about that. I can imagine how frustrating that would be, especially it sounds like it comes on at the end of the process. I'm going to give Amazon a free bit of advice, my own expertise. If your bar raisers can be your recruitment HR team right up front, And they're saying that they're going through a ton of different interviews, but they're making sure we're not even going to pass this person along unless they have that bar raising, whether it be cultural leadership principles, whatever it means. Then there's less issues when it gets to you and your team. And if your team signs off, you can feel really good about it. I'm sure there's flaws in that line of thinking, but just for me, I love the idea. I think it's really important to have. And I think I love the idea of it being somebody outside of HR and recruitment that doesn't have an incentive lined up for this placement going through. But I also think, man, it's got to be so frustrating for your team to get through the process only to have the bar raiser kill it. I just feel like there's got to be a better way to have that same kind of mentality and thought process without having so much, I wouldn't say wasted time, but so much frustration in the process, because that's going to be frustrating for the candidate too. Yeah. So interesting.
Their view is it's worse to make a bad hire than to pass on a good hire, right?
No question. I would just figure out, can I get that part earlier on in the process so that we can be as optimal as we can? But I love it. I look up to Amazon. I think it's amazing. What about, is there anything about the hiring process that maybe frustrates you? Like just in general, either being a candidate, and you've been a candidate now a few times, maybe on that. What's something that you wish that you could fix? And maybe even Amazon hasn't quite gotten this right yet.
So for me, I mean, that sense of urgency I talked about earlier, I like things to happen fast. And that's just not the way that hiring works, right? Is you do want to take a little bit of time to make sure that you're getting the right candidates. But at the same time, in a hot job market or with jobs that are really low supply of talent for them, you have to move fast in order to get the talent right that you need. So for me, it's just moving fast enough that sometimes can be frustrating. We don't need weeks or months. Like, we need days to do some of the stuff.
Right? Yeah, listen, time is the enemy of any hiring process. I know that firsthand. And what I'll say is, this is where I think AI can make a tremendous difference, right? Where we can speed things up and cut down on cycles without forsaking quality. Because it is a catch-22 type situation, right? You need the time to do it right. But if you have time, if you spend too much time, you're going to lose out on the top talent you need or keep a role open that's super critical. So to me, it's about the AI aspect of it, but also having people that have a very urgent mindset and a bias to action and not being paper pushers or not just being perfunctory part of it. So totally with you on that. Last question on the hiring side for me, we've all missed. And so do you see a theme, like when you go back and look at the times you've missed, maybe a bias or a common mistake that you've made that hopefully over time you've started to rectify?
So for me, I guess when I think back through some of the misses, I guess looking back on it is just not being concise in my answers. If I ramble, that tends to be the theme in jobs that I haven't got that I wanted, right? It's just rambling instead of being really prepared and really concise. So for me, preparation is key, and doing some level of prep is always helpful for me. And if I don't do the prep or I don't do as much prep as I need to, that's usually where I stumble.
Tim, I love that. I was asking that from the manager point of view, but I love that you said it from the candidate point of view. That is a really good insight and take. And we have a lot more candidates listening to this podcast than managers. So that is awesome, awesome stuff. I love that. Thank you for sharing. This is more of a curiosity. You hire in cybersecurity. Are there certain behavioral attributes that you're looking for in terms of people in this space that might be unique and different from, say, somebody in marketing or operations or HR?
Yeah, for me, it comes back to that sense of urgency. It is. The wolf is always at the door. Things can't get done fast enough in cyber. And so having a really well-developed sense of urgency for me is super important. The other thing is also being balanced, right? There's a lot of people in cyber that are adrenaline junkies, and that's fine, right? Like, they love the whole incident response aspect of it, or they love threat hunting, or that's awesome, right? But being able to balance that with an interest in business is really powerful, right? So instead of just indexing on technology and being a technologist, being interested in the business and how the business functions and organizational behavior and all of that stuff, those candidates are much harder to find, but they seem to be the ones that sort of rise to the top, right? Because they don't have a one-dimensional or two-dimensional view of the world. It's like they understand more about business and organizational behavior, and that helps them be better cybersecurity professionals, in my view.
Love that. Okay, let's take a little bit of a different direction. We are going to come to our speed round, and you don't know what's coming there, so be ready for that. But a couple questions first. Do you have a good book you read recently you'd recommend for our listeners, or really any type of content? If you saw something great on TV or a movie, please share.
Yeah. So we talked about mentors and mentees earlier. There's a book that I often recommend to people in their first management role or as they get close to director. And that's what got you here won't get you there. Do you have it on your shelf? Yeah, it's just a classic B school book. And that for me, when I made the move and finally got promoted to director at Microsoft, it took a long time. And part of that journey was understanding that the focus on technology and really being technical and so on wasn't going to get me to the director role and pass the director role and the types of jobs I was pursuing. It was actually holding me back. And so again, I had to start focusing on other aspects of my professional development. And I had a manager that said, Tim, I'm forbidding you from using a compiler. And because I was writing all these tools, I was a developer writing cybersecurity tools. And she said, I forbid you from using a compiler. And obviously I was like heartbroken because that was my thing. But she said, we have to turn you from this icky tools guy into a director. And that was a book that I read on that journey that really resonated with me.
Oh, love that. And I'll tell you, I read that book, helped me in my career. I started my career in corporate America at ADT. I don't know if you knew that, but also as an entrepreneur, right? What your company, what leads to success initially, all the time, you have to rethink everything when you get to a certain level and you plateau because scrappiness doesn't scale. And so now thinking in terms of process and systems, and it's really disorienting because you're like, wait a minute, we've been playing this game for 10, 15 years and had a lot of success, but you hit a ceiling unless you're able to readapt your mind. And I think it's the same thing as being an IC moving into an executive level role, and you have to reframe. The things that made you successful leading up to that are complete rethinking ultimately to get there. So I love that. Great book. Highly recommend that to everybody listening to this. All right, last question, Tim, before our speed round, of course. What's some advice you'd give 20-year-old Tim that you didn't know then, but that you know now?
Probably have a lot more confidence in yourself. You know, I was as competitive as you get when I worked at Microsoft. Like, you have to be competitive to work there. I was as competitive as you get. And I got really good review scores and I was really successful there. But the thing that was motivating me was fear, right? It was fear of failure. And as I got older and I started to have more success and got promoted and got into executive roles, I realized that I was probably always going to be able to succeed just because I'm disciplined and focused. I don't have to be like hyper competitive. And so I would give my 20-year-old self that advice. I'd just say, look, be more confident in yourself. You don't have to be hyper competitive. You have to be competitive, but not hyper competitive.
That's a real interesting thing you say that I went through that lesson myself. And I'm going to be honest with you, the most recent turn was I need a little bit, get my competitive edge back, because like you, I was maniacal about my competitiveness, like stupid about it, to be honest. Like the type of guy, like, you didn't want to invite me over to hang out with the in-laws and play board games because I just cared too much and I wanted to win. And it's just relax. And so actually, as I ascended my career and became CEO of the company back in 2019, I wanted to take a little bit of that edge off and be a little more magnanimous, change the way I approach it, which I think to some degree was successful. But as I reflected over the last 18 months, it's also what made me great. And so maybe I had turned down the volume a little bit too much on that. So I'm trying to bring that competitive intensity back. So funny how we go through these maturations throughout our career. And
Well, another way to think about it is you're not applying for your own job in every meeting you're in.
I'm not. But there's a sense of I can take a little bit of a step back and X, Y, Z. But you know what I really realized? I realized it changed the mentality of my people. Right. So we grew as a very competitive organization that we were like competing internal competition, but like having a high bar, right? Bar raiser. And I think what I realized is I took my foot off that gas personally. I noticed it started to seep a little bit into the organization. And so now we're in a process of refining ourselves and doing that over the last 8 to 12 months. And that's been super successful. So it's always a balance with these things, right? So, Tim, I'm telling you, don't let that competitiveness go completely dormant. There might be a time where you need to tap back into that reserve. And it's just a matter of channeling it, making it work for you, not against you. That's what I always like to say. All right. Speed round. Here we go, Tim. Seattle version. All right. First question. Favorite Seahawk of all time?
Oh, Beast Mode.
Beast Mode. All right. Marshawn Lynch. One of my favorites too. Love that. What is the saddest Seattle sports moment of your life?
Losing the basketball team.
I knew you were going to say it. The Supersonics. Can you believe it? Kevin Durant would have been a Supersonic. The team that you see right now that's leading the Western Conference should have been a Seattle team. I think it's one of the biggest travesties in sports history. Give Seattle a team back. Sounds like it's on the way. Gosh darn it. That's a great basketball city. I don't know if people realize that because there's so much rain there. People go indoors to play basketball. And you've got some amazing players that have come out of that area. Jamal Crawford, Martell Webster, Brandon Roy. There's a lot of really great players. Nate Robinson, I think, came out of there. So there's a lot of really great players that came out of that area. Great basketball community. Hope you get it back. All right. More ubiquitous in Seattle. Coffee or rain?
Oh, rain.
What about best coffee? Where do we get the best coffee if we want to go?
That's a good question. I have an espresso maker here at home, and I use Lavazza a lot.
Come to Tim's house. That's an open invite.
Yeah.
Make you a Lavazza.
That's right. I have. There are at least three Starbucks within two blocks of my house.
I would hope so. My goodness. What about, I think it's an underrated food scene out there. What's your favorite restaurant?
Oh, that's a good question. So one of the newer restaurants that came out here in after the pandemic ended is called Ascend. So they're a steak and sushi house in Bellevue, Washington. Expensive, but I've never had a bad meal there.
Ascend? All right, I'm writing that down on the list because I have worked with T-Mobile in the past. And so when I make my next visit out there, I'm gonna have to hit up Ascend.
Nice.
In Bellevue. I know
Global
that area.
All
too.
About it. Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, and I have family out in Mercer Island, too. That's a nice area, but not as many good restaurants out there. You got to leave the island to find the good food. All right, last one. Is this a myth or not? The Seattle freeze. Is that a real thing?
It's absolutely a real thing. Yeah, absolutely.
It's a real thing. So what is, explain it to the people that don't know what it is.
Sure. When I lived in London, people wouldn't talk to other people on the streets or whatever because you don't know, what does this person want? What are they motivated by? Why are they talking to me? But in Seattle, a lot of people theorize that this lack of sociability, right? You're out on the street, you're walking around and people won't make eye contact with you. They're not very friendly. But if you get introduced to them, suddenly they're very friendly and they could turn out to be your best friend, right? But there's a lot of theories like why does that exist, right? Is it because there's lots of engineers here and they're introverted? Or is it because it rains and so people are never like going to stand around outside and talk? But I experienced it when I moved here in the late 90s. I absolutely experienced it, right? Yeah, I think it's a real thing.
Yeah, it's also like you got like Seattle is like right at the top. Like I live in South Florida. I couldn't be any further from Seattle. Like you're right in the top corner. It's isolated from everything else. I know you got Portland not too far away, but otherwise like it is like just regionally and geographically a little bit isolated too. So Tim, I'm asking, if I come to Seattle, you're going to welcome me with open arms?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Especially if you take me to Ascend.
That's it. It's in. It's on. I'll be there. Brother, I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much for the time, Tim. It was a great show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.